welcome back to This Week on Channel 9. I'm Brian Keller.
I'm Dan Fernandez.
And we've got a lot in store for you. Hacking voice and speech to control your computer.
How to be an army of one.
And something about Warcraft and Twitter.
Tweetcraft, baby.
Tweetcraft.
It's what the kids are doing on the internets these days.
I'm so out of touch. I can't wait to find out more about this.
Let's jump into our first story.
Let's do it. So this is talking to your computer and having the .NET speech APIs actually interpret that and convert that into PowerShell commands.
Right. So Windows Vista shipped with the ability for you to actually control your PC via voice. Right. So you can talk to your computer, give it commands. This shows how to do it with PowerShell and how you can actually control home automation gear like Z-Wave gear or X10. And we've done that way back in the day, if you remember, with On Coding for Fun.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Isn't he that guy?
That's right.
Northrop.
Yes, Tony Northrop.
Yes.
Yeah, he wrote some articles for us.
Yes.
And my friend Mike Iam actually wired that up to his house and sent everyone the website link and then forgot to password protect it later on. So you could actually go to his house and like turn the lights on and off in the middle of the night.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So you have
hilarious.
To be careful with this stuff. But,
yes, yes.
But it's really exciting. You can get home, you know.
And I think
Xbox
this is
on.
Cool, if nothing, to show the power of PowerShell on how you can use the full framework for this stuff.
Yep.
Now, another example is speech recognition WPF.
Yeah, so this is another sample that that talks about how to program your own speech recognition application. And so it talks about how you can use a grammar so that rather than having the speech recognition APIs go through and search through the entire, for example, English dictionary, you say, hey, here's my domain, here's what I'm talking about, so I expect these sets of words, and that just improves the speech recognition's ability to narrow in on that set of words.
Right, so it's like, people have probably done this before with maybe a tell me service or, you know, calling 1-800-411 or whatever it
is. Why don't you just tell me the name of the movie?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, if you say the word buy, there's a grammar that says buy means now give them this audio clue, sell means, you know, go back, or menu means go
right.
here.
It doesn't mean goodbye.
No, it doesn't.
Well, how do you say goodbye?
You have to say it in Spanish.
Hasta luego.
Adios.
And speaking of audio, another friend of the show, Dan Waters, wrote an excellent series on how audio, like the mechanics of audio, how to work with it within your computer, all the different components technically of working with audio. And so he had to go through an exercise for one of his X&A games to actually learn a lot about this. And so he's converted this into a series of articles that you too can learn from.
Yeah, this is, you know, audio programming is one of those things that's not really covered that well on the internet. Or if it is, it's using Direct Show and it's C++. Just, it hurts my brain. So the first level he goes through is really just how high level, how sound works, how sound waves work, mono, stereo, all the typical things that maybe you've heard before, the bits, etc. And then he goes into actual programming and programming libraries he has for audio programming.
Right.
So this is definitely cool stuff. Highly recommended.
And while we're talking about audio, and since I just mentioned X&A, I'm dying to know, this is purely my speculation, but I'm dying to know what they intend to do with the Project Natal and its support for having microphones built in. Number one, we're waiting to find out whether or not X&A is going to support Project Natal.
Correct.
And then number two, what kind of library specifically around audio input they'll enable. In addition to all the visual recognition, they also have that audio recognition and the directional microphones. And
could you imagine, really, like, cool. it takes a picture and then it can automatically recognize your face and you plug it into an app? Like, I don't ever have to type in my password again. I just need to get in my face, it scans my face, and boom, I'm logged in.
And that's why my Daniel Fernandez mask is going to come in handy, because I'll just log into your computer.
Right.
Right.
So team of one.
That's right. So this is Andrew Woodward.
Yes.
And Andrew Woodward took the opportunity to blog about his experience working by himself and trying to apply agile techniques and processes and everything. And so, if you embrace agile, you know, it's a lot about rapid communication between you and the other team members and the customer or whoever you're building the application for. So how does that apply for a team of one? I mean, you're not going to stand up in the morning and be like,
let's go around the table.
Yeah. this is what I did yesterday. I'm really proud of it. Oh, good job. You know, this is what I'm going to do today. And I'm blocked by me because I don't know what I'm doing.
Blocked by?
Yeah.
Yeah, every single item is going to be blocked by him.
Exactly. So so he kind of takes a fresh look at that experience and talks about what it's like when you're working by yourself to do that.
Yeah, I think it's he has one example. He even shows a screenshot of his whiteboard where he's like literally moving post-it notes around on sort of features and mm-hmm. a number of things. So definitely check out this post.
Nice.
And related to Army of One or Team of One post is this is Frank Levine posted a video by Leah Budley, just to get her name right. And this was at South by Southwest. But how do you actually design applications, the user experience for applications or websites, when you're a team of one, right? So how do you make sure that you're going through the whole process and whether you're a diviner, for example, a developer and designer.
A diviner?
A diviner, yes. Or what did you want to call it? Dezeloper?
Dezeloper is
you
my,
want
Dezeloper
to
yeah,
catch on?
That's right.
So she goes through, highly rated. Definitely check this out.
Nice. So we've talked a few times in the past about extending Visual Studio 2010, about the new VSIX format, the work that Quan To and Weston Hutchins are doing, and all those guys. Now they've just published a UI guideline for if you're building applications or add-ins or samples or other things that need to integrate within Visual Studio 2010. How can you make sure that what you build conforms to the rest of the Visual Studio 2010 look and feel, the color scheme, all the different button styles and things like that.
Exactly. Everything from interaction to actual APIs that you should be calling.
Mm-hmm.
Things like, don't animate unless you really need to, use WPF. And you can tell this is actually the spec that's being used for Visual Studio 2010, because at the very top it even says, LCA, Microsoft Confidential.
Which oh, nice.
They probably should have removed just so people don't add confusion.
Yeah.
But kudos to Aaron Martin and team for publishing this, because it's great to see. And this is a huge document. And in some cases, probably a little overwhelming if mm-hmm. somebody's still building their app, but definitely a great reference.
But very prescriptive.
Yes, exactly. Very prescriptive.
Yep. Cool. So Corey Schumann, talks about how you can actually watch YouTube videos with Silverlight. So YouTube by default supports Flash, but what is the video format under the covers?
H.264.
And you know a little bit about this because you've done work on InnerTube for your Coding for Fun book, right?
Yes. So one of the things, what's interesting is iPhone, for example, doesn't have a Flash player, but it's able to play YouTube videos because it supports H.264.
Mm.
So, which is interesting in that Silverlight 3 will support H.264
natively.
Video.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So long as you can get a URL to a YouTube video, and we've talked about this on a previous this week on Channel 9, all the hoops you need to jump through to actually get that URL, you can watch a Silverlight a YouTube video in Silverlight 3 just by setting the media property.
That's right. And if people
want a fully qualified URL.
And if people understand how to get to the source of the video, they can buy your book, right? Coding for Fun.
Yeah, that's right.
Call See? Now. Supplies are limited.
Exactly.
Yep.
So definitely check this out.
Nice. So yet another history of Microsoft. So Tina has been coming out with some really great videos every few weeks on the history of Microsoft. And this one's 1995, which is significant because, number one, it was Bill's first CES show, right?
Yes.
And number two...
What does he decide to show there?
Microsoft Bob, baby.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I would just love to know what the excitement was in the room. Like, I would love to go back and look at some of the articles. Like, did they know then that it was going to go down as like this big failure, or was it actually something they were really excited
yeah,
about?
Yeah, or like the people like, this is going to destroy everyone, or the other part would be Microsoft's just copying, Microsoft Alice,
IBM Tim,
Tim, and this is a blatant ripoff of IBM Tim.
Yep,
which would be hilarious. And then of course Windows 95 launching and all that stuff. So a pretty huge year in terms of history of Microsoft. So
yeah, absolutely. It launched August 25th, 1995 is when it launched.
Definitely
August 25th. Yeah, I was actually working at a computer store that my friends and I started out of the local mall. And I remember it was really exciting that Windows 95 was coming. We were just bracing for it.
Oh, so, I didn't know you were a loser.
Yeah, I was, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yep.
Okay, so...
All right, this will be my last show.
Jaime Rodriguez talks about we have internal email aliases where people can ask questions. One of them is called WPF discussions, but they're Anybody that's inside the firewall can join these aliases. Most of these aliases are open to anyone, including contingent staff, vendors, and full-time employees. And there's huge traffic on these, mm-hmm. like, you know, 300 a day. But and a lot of great knowledge is in there.
So, oh, so like product team members that are in there. Microsoft
the guy who
consulting
designed
services.
The feature.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
So what Jaime did was looked at the emails from that thread and actually gave the subject details and then the actual answer to them. So he went through all these emails. Like one example is actually. When you have a data context and it's null, it's actually going to throw an exception. So what happens in that case? How can you get around it when it's null rather than doing some crazy things to, you know, pass in a null value or something like that? There's something called a fallback value that you can use and easily program it. Yeah, exactly.
No idea.
So game loops in WPF, just definitely check this out. A lot of great knowledge in there in terms of best practices, in terms of things you hang-ups that people will get.
Exactly. Yeah.
And kudos to Jaime for putting this up too.
Yep, definitely. Sometimes I wonder what I would do if I was not a Microsoft employee and not being able to benefit from some of those DLs. So I think it's a great idea that Jaime is doing that, and I've actually got some of my own DLs that I might want to go out and start start scrubbing around VSTS and things like that.
That would be great, seriously.
Yeah, definitely.
So what's this?
Our friends down at MySpace recently released a plugin for Internet Explorer that can show you how web pages are loading. So this is really helpful if you're trying to program and make sure that your apps are fast on Internet Explorer. Of course, Firefox has similar features that have been
Firebug,
around for a while.
Firebug, yeah. People know Firebug.
Yep, but I'm not aware of anything that's quite this rich for Internet Explorer. So nice to see them releasing that and kind of giving back to the web community.
Yeah.
So,
Definitely check this out. It's got, I think the crazy part is the performance handling where you can see how your page is being rendered and actually do the breakout of the graph. So see what parts are killing your page.
Which images, JavaScript.
Exactly.
Other resources. Exactly. Yep. Cool. So this is our friend Greg Duncan that pointed to an article that talks about how to register your own file types for the previews that you have within Vista. That let's say you're looking at a directory full of images and it has thumbnail previews and it shows you what those JPEGs were. Well, what if instead of having those JPEGs in there, you wanted to have a special type of file? Maybe like the example that we talked about here was registry files. So you want to be able to show just kind of the first few lines of text of those registry files. Well, this talks about how you can do that and how you can actually override the default kind of thumbnail preview that exists within those thumbnail views.
Sweet.
So, yep. Logging is not tracing.
Yeah, so this is Alois Krauss. Hopefully I got his name right. But he goes into some of the things and misconceptions in terms of logging and tracing. So mm-hmm. when you think about logging, it's really your application's running production level, and it is capturing errors and seeing what's, like when errors happen, it logs the error. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's running to event log, maybe it's running to a custom log provider or whatever.
Or how long it took to run a particular function. Is that an example of logging?
No, that's an example of tracing.
Ah, okay.
Oh.
All right, educate me.
Yes. So logging is something, you know, you can have it turned on, and it'll only happen in the exceptional cases, right? Mm-hmm. Something breaks, you know, I'm going to call, you know, this Windows service to record my error, whatever it happens to be.
Okay.
Tracing, on the other hand, is when you're actually seeing how the application is either performing or seeing how the application flow, right? So I want to trace and see, why isn't it calling, you know, the login service first and then trying to get at data because it keeps failing on some security exception. So it shows you sort of the application flow and captures a bunch more information in terms of performance, mm-hmm. you know, when this method was called, start and end, et cetera. And it's not something that you'd want to have in a production environment.
Gotcha.
Right? It's like when you're figuring out why the application's doing what it does.
Gotcha.
So a really interesting article that goes through sort of the differences and misconceptions, because a lot of people kind of combine both.
Obviously, I did. Yep.
Yes.
Cool. Good article. Time for a Picks of the Week.
Picks of the Week!
So this is another friend of the show, Habib Hadarian, that we've talked about in the past, and he's just been on a tear lately with
blogging
some awesome
tear.
Blog posts.
And he started posting to Channel 9, too.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he's been uploading some videos there, so he must get paid by the blog post or something. I don't know. but anyway, one of the features that his team looks after is the historical debugger that's coming in Visual Studio 2010. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people may be wondering how to actually use that. Now that the Beta 1 is available, you can go set it up, watch 10.4 episode 20, and figure out how to get that running on your own VM if you want.
Plug! This is going to be a plug fest episode.
I'm almost at 100,000 views last time I checked. But anyway, Habib takes you through step by step with some really awesome screenshots of exactly how to turn on historic debugger logs. So, or I guess maybe it's a trace now. Now I'm questioning myself. So it's actually a trace. I can answer that emphatically. Basically, as you run through your automated tests, you can have these historical debugging traces enabled in the background. And then if there's an exception, like let's say you've got 100 unit tests and three of those fail, then you can have those logs, those trace files, automatically become available for you so that you can open them up and you can see, okay, why did this exception get thrown? When was this registry key read? When did this variable change a particular state? Any of the things that the historical debugger enables for you. But in order to do that, you have to make some settings to your test runs, changes to your test settings, because different test settings have different configurations of which data collectors you have enabled. And so one might be the historical debugger trace, another might be code coverage analysis, another might be test impact analysis, videos, all sorts of things that you can enable to run while your automated tests are being run in the background.
Sure.
But he basically takes you through and shows you how to do that.
Yeah, and this particular example, he's like, well, what happens when your unit test actually throws an exception? And it really shouldn't. It should either pass or fail.
Yep.
And how do you actually debug a unit test. So in this case, I think the example was like some references weren't in there.
Right.
For example.
But it doesn't have to be a unit test. It could be it could be a one of the new coded UI tests that we have coming. So basically anything that's managed code, .NET Framework 2.0 and above, you can do this historical debugging on.
Yeah.
So.
Love it.
Yep.
Love it. So my pick of the week is
Tweetcraft.
So Tweetcraft is a coding for fun production. And what it is Gabber Radke, Mike Sampson, and I built Tweetcraft. And really, Gabber did all the work. We just designed some of that. Lincoln Anderson from 352 Media actually designed the UI for the Windows app. But what it is a Twitter client inside World of Warcraft.
Okay.
So it does all the work of, it's a test tray application in Windows, all the work of syncing data from and to Twitter into World of Warcraft. So it's not, doing any sort of memory hacks. It's just using the saved variables as outlined in the Coding for Fun book.
Another plug.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same technique we used for RSS Reader.
So how does this work then? I don't play World of Warcraft, but if I did, then I'd be walking around and I'd be like, hey, I just found some gold, right? And I tweet that to my friends. Or is the idea that it automatically picks up events that happen, like, hey, Daniel Effie just died, whatever?
Yeah, so there's a couple different ways it works. One is you can send a message, and the only thing is you have to reload the UI when you're sending messages just randomly. Now, if you die, chances are you're zoning out, so your UI will reload, like if you die in a dungeon. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so it would automatically send, and you can tell it what messages to auto-tweet. So auto-tweet, you can send it when you log in, log out, so that way you can know if Brian's on, maybe I want to play with Brian, I'll know his character and his server that he's logged in.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also sign up for achievements. So much like Xbox achievements, you can sign in. When you hit that achievement, boom, you automatically, it'll automatically send a message to Twitter.
Nice.
And you can extend it, so you can say, like, on death, on whatever, or Brian just beat, an orc.
Nice.
If you beat an orc, then you can actually have it send custom messages. The other cool part is sending screenshots too. So
nice. I can't wait for the series of tweets from your account. Daniel Effie is homesick today. Cough cough. Next up, Daniel Effie just leveled up level 65 paladin or whatever. So
I play a paladin.
So I understand you have a trailer for us to check
out.
Yes,
we do have a trailer.
Nice.
Coding for Fun production, and we will leave you on that. Happy 4th of July, and thanks everyone.
We'll see you next week.